This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we speak with Arun Kundanani on his new book, The Muslims Are Coming. It's about Islamophobia, extremism, and the domestic war on terror. We'll also speak with scholar and author Joel Covell on the situation in the Ukraine, which involves neo-Nazis, anti-Semites, and people with ties to the Holocaust during World War II.
Stay with us.
I'm New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, executive director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, president emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
So-called experts whom we've relied upon to explain terrorism have failed to grasp its causes and have shied away from highlighting the role of Western foreign policy in driving terrorist attacks. Instead, Muslim culture has been blamed, feeding an official undercurrent of Islamophobia. The same experts have invented so-called radicalization models, which legitimize and organize state surveillance and claim knowledge of the behavioral and ideological signals that indicate someone is likely to be a terrorist. But the models do not stand up to objective scrutiny. Arun Kundanani's recent book titled The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror carefully looks at the ideologies and strategies of law enforcement used to create the domestic war on terror. He unveils the disturbing process of radicalization theories and racial profiling followed by law enforcement. Arun joins us in the studio to talk more about his book and the research involved. Arun, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thanks for having me. My pleasure.
I have to say, the Muslims are coming. Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror is one of the really fine books that I've read on this subject in the last 10, 12 years since I've been thinking a lot about it and since this show has covered it. Since 9/11, there's been a lot written about it, but this is really the most profound book, and I'm so glad to have you on the show. The Muslims are coming. Let me just read the first line from Chapter 9 and then ask you a question about it. Mainstream popular culture in the period since 9/11 has remained slavishly faithful to the official narratives of the war on terror. The so-called experts whom we've relied upon to explain terrorism have failed to grasp its causes and shied away from the highlighting of the role of Western foreign policy in driving terrorist attacks. Instead, Muslim culture has been blamed, feeding an official undercurrent of Islamophobia. We continue to assume that terrorism is driven by Islam, or a particular extremist interpretation of Islam, when in fact it makes more sense to see terrorism as having its origins in politics rather than religion. How did the discussion after 9/11 about why terrorism was used against the American people, what was that discussion like right afterwards?
Right, so the immediate discussion that took place wasn't really a discussion at all. It was just a series of kind of cliches that talked about, you know, terrorism as this kind of evil ideology or something like that, or the idea that that Bush put out at the time, you know, that they hate us for our freedoms, that kind of idea. And then there was a kind of undercurrent in some of the neoconservatives around the time about this idea of a clash of civilizations, right? So this was a kind of global, long-term conflict between the West and Islam. But there wasn't really any kind of reflection on what the kind of political causes might be of 9/11, or even the kind of political context that might give rise to Al-Qaeda. That discussion was basically censored, at least within the United States. People in the rest of the world were certainly talking about it. That was the situation for quite a few years. The kind of an interesting thing happens towards the end of the Bush period, right, when the war on terror has basically failed, right? The Iraq war did not kind of lead to the outcome that was expected by the neoconservatives. You started to get a situation where citizens of European countries were carrying out terrorist attacks within those countries themselves. And the thing seemed to have ended in a kind of, it seemed to have been counterproductive at that point, right? The whole approach to the war on terror. So then you start to get what for me is a much more interesting kind of discussion, but one that is still flawed, but actually is now the dominant way of thinking about terrorism, which is through this idea of radicalization, right? Which I think is now the kind of chief lens through which security officials in Western governments look at Muslim populations. And so this notion of radicalization basically does this thing where it says there's a kind of ideology out there that turns ordinary Muslims into terrorists, right? And so that becomes the basic model.
Rather than the reality of the effect of American policy on the rest of the world, the scholars instead are studying the Quran and the commentaries on the Quran and saying that Islam, or at least a extreme version of Islam, leads to terrorism. And I remember vividly years ago, before 9/11, but after the first American attack on Iraq, and then the sanctions that were placed on Iraq, and Leslie Stahl, who was one of the main reporters on a CBS program called 60 Minutes, had the Secretary of State on, Madeleine Albright, and she said, "Madam Secretary, we understand that 600,000 children have died as a result of the sanctions on Iraq. 600,000 Iraqi children. Was it worth it?" And Albright thought for a second and said, "Yes." And then I remember Osama bin Laden, the person most responsible for 9/11, was asked why. And he said three reasons. He said one is the presence of American military bases in Saudi Arabia next to our two most holy cities, Mecca and Medina, and the support that the United States gives to Israel, and third, what it's done to Iraq. But that discussion was terminated. Susan Sontag, who was a leading American intellectual, she's dead now, but after 9/11, she began that discussion and was censored, like you say, and it never happened. And now we have a discussion, but it's not a realistic discussion. It's a discussion about Islam and its culture. And you point out in your book, The Muslims Are Coming, that the experts have designated four stages to the radicalization of a Muslim person. Talk to us about that.
Right. So the FBI and the New York Police Department both have the same kind of model of radicalization, which they claim tells you the process that someone goes through from being an ordinary member of the public to becoming a terrorist, right? And within that, there's various indicators of things like behavior and things that people might say or believe that are supposed to be signs that someone is traveling along this path to becoming a terrorist. And so this then provides the basis for the kind of very aggressive practices of surveillance that we've seen from both of those law enforcement agencies. And it enables them to have a kind of grid, a kind of frame of reference to try and intervene within Muslim populations in the United States to tackle the ideology that they see as the root driver of this, right?
What are their indices of a person who's tending to get radicalized?
Right. So there's four stages to this model. In the second stage, you have things like growing a beard, wearing what they call Islamic clothing, changing the mosque that you attend. And in the third stage, which is in their model one stage away from being an active terrorist, there's things like being active in a pro-Muslim social or political group, right? So these are all obviously perfectly lawful behaviors, and they often correspond to expressions of political opinion, right? So what's being taken as indicators of a potential terrorist threat is actually people who are dissenters, who are expressing maybe critical opinions about US foreign policy, right? So this becomes another way in which that conversation gets shut down, right? Because to have that conversation about foreign policy attracts the attention of the counter-terrorist operatives.
What kind of blanket coverage of the Muslim community have the New York City Police Department, the FBI, Homeland Security, and a myriad of American police groups? What have they done to surveil the Muslim community?
Right. Well, the New York Police Department until just recently has been running something called a demographics unit. And its role was to basically systematically surveil every aspect of Muslim life within the tri-state area, right? So 250 mosques have been under surveillance. Lots of South Asian and Arab American restaurants in the New York area have had informants and undercover agents regularly going in there, right? So in a weird way, the city has been subsidizing the South Asian and Arab restaurant businesses. And it's the funny thing with that is it's not even the, you know, the restaurants that seem to have attracted the most attention are actually the best restaurants, right? So you can see a lot of officers thinking this is just some free meals. The FBI, as of 2008, had 15,000 paid informants on its books, right? So that's a huge number of people. We don't know the number that are specifically focused on Muslim populations in the US, but given that half of the FBI's budget is on counterterrorism, and given that they understand counterterrorism to be counter-Muslim terrorism, it's reasonable to assume that, you know, a substantial number of those informants are operating in Muslim communities. And we know from a lot of the prosecutions that have taken place that sting operations using informants are their kind of key method of dealing with this. Just to have a kind of comparison here, the Stasi in East Germany had one.
That was the famous secret police in
right,
East Germany.
Right, the famous secret police in East Germany who,
after the Second World War, up until 91 or so.
Right, right, and you know, in a way, that is our kind of classic image of what a totalitarian state looks like. Right, they had one spy for every 66 East German citizens. Okay, it's that kind of ratio in which you can talk about a totalitarian system of surveillance. We don't know the exact numbers, but it looks like it's a reasonable estimate to think that the number of spies in various agencies in the US who are dedicated to having Muslims in America under surveillance, it looks like the same sort of ratio, right? So Muslims in America are probably experiencing the same level of surveillance that East German citizens faced under the Stasi. One of the kind of other elements of this is, you know, there's that famous moment when the communist regime in East Germany is overthrown in 91, and East Germans go into the Stasi offices and pick up the files and find out suddenly that this friend of theirs was actually, you know, passing information to the government about their political opinions and so forth. So this kind of moment of realizing how intense this was and how, you know, people that are very close to you have been caught up in this. And we've actually had that experience in New York, right, where Muslims, as a result of some of the leaks that have happened over the last couple of years, are finding out that a friend of theirs was actually a paid informant for the NYPD, or their restaurant had been systematically surveilled, right? So that experience that in our conventional way of thinking we only associate with totalitarian regimes is something that Muslims are experiencing here in the United States.
We're speaking with Arun Kundanani, who wrote "The Muslims Are Coming: Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror." Arun, why did you call the book "The Muslims Are Coming"? It reminds me of that comic movie of years ago called "The Russians Are Coming." Of course, that was an anti-communist kind of joke. Right. Why do you call it "The Muslims Are Coming"?
Right.
What's the comparison?
Well, the phrase actually comes from an article by someone called Daniel Pipes from the 1990s, who was one of the kind of prominent ideologues of Islamophobia in the United States. And in the article, he kind of makes an argument about how Muslims are coming to take over the United States. And so it's kind of ironic. But certainly the film "The Russians Are Coming" is a useful kind of analogy here, because, you know, there's a lot of parallels with the Cold War in the way that Muslims are seen as a threat and as in a similar way to communists were in the Cold War. One of the things that's interesting about the film "The Russians Are Coming" is it's one of these films that comes out of a particular moment in the 1960s where you have a kind of you've moved on from the very intense kind of McCarthyite period of the early Cold War, and you're moving into a more liberal take. And what that liberal take basically says is Russians are okay as long as they accommodate themselves to our ideology, right? So you set up a kind of allegiance test, right, in terms of how you think about your threat. And that's what we have now in the United States with Muslims. So the liberal take on the war on terror is not the same as the neoconservative take. It's not saying Islam is inherently evil. It's not saying all Muslims are bad, but it's saying as a Muslim, you're potentially bad and you need to prove that you're not, right, by the kind of ideology that you express. And that's really what's characterized the Obama period in the war on terror. And this is the thing that, you know, I think we're kind of familiar with the neoconservative agenda now, and that has been kind of critiqued, but we haven't really focused on this kind of liberal war on terror so much. And that's one of the things I try and do in the book.
The Red Scare and anti-communism that we've now surpassed, and we now have a Muslim scare. But the anti-communism scare was really used to prevent progressive social change. And I wanted to talk to you about that and how the anti-Muslim scare could be used for the same purposes.
Right, right. So I think, you know, one of the things that you notice when you look at this area is that the people who have been picked up and the people who are being demonized within the kind of rhetoric of this war on terror are often people who have strong critiques of US empire or US foreign policy, right? And this is one of the kind of, I think one of the most significant things that, again, is not really picked up in the discussion. The way that the word terrorism or the word extremism or the word radicalization works is it serves to criminalize and demonize people who have radical political opinions, right? Irrespective of whether they are involved in any kind of violence. What counts is what is your ideology? Is it radical, right? And so you see this this phenomenon in the war on terror where there's been many cases where people have been considered terrorists simply for expressing critical opinions of US foreign policy, for expressing critical opinions of Israeli policy. And so one of the kind of costs here for us as a society in the US is that we lose the knowledge that Muslim populations have about the effects of our foreign policy around the world, right? We lose that contribution to the debate within the US because that debate is silenced.
And more broadly speaking, the kind of surveillance network that's been set up is useful not just to surveil Muslims, but to surveil everybody. I think that the slogan of the NSA, which you quote in your book, is collect it all.
Right.
And
right.
Jimmy Carter said a couple of months ago, former president, that we no longer live in a functioning democracy. This right. was after the Snowden revelations came
right.
out. And what is the relationship between that blanket surveillance, really, without being melodramatic, really a police state surveillance of, mm-hmm. of all of our citizens. What's the relationship between that and Islamophobia?
Right. Well, so certainly the structures of surveillance that have been set up in the war on terror get recycled for all kinds of other purposes, right? So we've seen the same structures used on left-wing activists, people who are active around foreign policy in Latin America. We've seen it targeted at people who are protesting against Bush or Obama. While it's true that the NSA seeks to collect everything about our digital lives, I think one of the, you know, we've had this debate following Edward Snowden's revelations about surveillance, which is I think a very positive development that people are starting to talk about this. But the debate has been, for me, a little bit abstract and a little bit legalistic. And one of the things that gets lost is that this surveillance is actually targeted at very at specific communities, right? So when you listen to people, NSA officials, they will talk about, you know, we don't target average guys, we target the bad guys, right? And one of the responses that you often hear from particularly the kind of tech community is, well, you know, the information we have is that you actually are targeting everyone. You are targeting the average guys, and we want you just to target the bad guys rather than everyone, right? My point is, well, what does it mean to say the bad guys, right? Who are the bad guys within the national security world? And that isn't people who are reasonably suspected of being involved in some kind of violence or crime. It's, you know, when you look at the kind of material on how they operate, this is basically political activists, Muslim populations, people involved in some kind of radical politics in minority communities, right? So even if as a result of this post-Snowden moment, we successfully advocated for the NSA to restrict itself just to the bad guys, which is where the debate is pushing, we would still have a massive problem here, right? And for me, we need to be a bit more critical here and understand that this phrase, the bad guys, covers up a whole heap of stuff around communities being demonized, right? And that's the history of what we know from, you know, the way national security works in the United States. So the national security state that we have has its origins in the US colonial regime in the Philippines, you know, around 100 years ago. That's when all these techniques were first developed around collecting information, using informants to criminalize dissent, leaking stuff to the media to discredit activists, that kind of stuff was all pioneered there. And then it was brought back to the internal security within the United States after World War One, right? And so the at the heart of national security has always been this notion of seeing racialized groups as a particular kind of threat, right? And then that carries on through COINTELPRO in the 1960s, which sees African American radical politics as the chief threat that it needs to deal with, and up to the present day, in which within the national security state, Muslims are racialized as a threat, right? They're seen as a continuation of this kind of problem of the racial other who has a radical politics.
We're speaking with Arun Kundanani, who has just had published the excellent book, The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror, just out by Verso Press, that excellent publishing house. And Arun, I can't thank you enough for your hard work in putting this book together.
Thank you very much.
Let's talk some more about how the effects of American foreign policy on people around the world are what you believe are the political causes of extremism, and not some kind of line in the Quran.
Right.
But all of that is really a discussion that's been avoided here. And but for scholars and political activists, scholars like yourself, we wouldn't have a discussion at all. And what points did you try to make in your book about that avoidance?
Right. So you know, the debate that's happened over the last few years around this is you have kind of conservatives who say, you know, Islam is a violent religion. Islam is a religion that hasn't been able to adapt itself to modernity and democracy and so forth. So it's a religion of violence. And then you have the kind of liberal response from particularly the kind of Obama world, where people say, no, you know, Islam is a religion of peace. But the problem is that there's a minority who've interpreted Islam in an extremist fashion, and that's what causes the problems here, right? And so that debate goes back and forth, and each side kind of trades lines from the Quran, and it really doesn't get anywhere, right? And what both sides in that debate are assuming is that Islamic theology has something to do with what makes someone a terrorist, right? And actually, the evidence for that is just not there, right? So a good way of thinking about this is to think about a group like Hamas, right? So Hamas uses religious ideology to legitimize its violence, but it also uses religious ideology to legitimize its ceasefires. So it's not the religious ideology that's driving its decision to use violence at a particular point or not. If you want to understand Hamas's violence, you need to understand the history of Israel's military occupation of Palestine, right? It's a political question. It's not really about the religion. And if you look at the history of terrorism, in all the cases of terrorism in the modern era over the last kind of 150 years, what produces that context within which terrorism happens is not political radicalization, but the failure of political radicalization, right? Terrorism tends to occur in moments of political defeat. So think about the anarchist bombers at the end of the 19th century. They come out of the suppression of the Paris Commune and the violence of that. Think about the IRA in Northern Ireland. Their violence comes out of that context of the British state's suppression of the civil rights movement in Northern Ireland. Think about the Weather Underground in the United States when they issue their declaration of a state of war against the US government in the early 1970s. It's on the back of the kind of military suppression of the student movement to stop the Vietnam War. So all of these are moments of actual political defeat for activism that produces a context in which terrorism happens. You see the same thing after 9/11. In Britain, the number of terrorist convictions between 2003 and 2006 more than doubles, right? Before, from 2006 to 2009, goes back down to the level it was at before. Now, that's not entirely due to the fact that Britain joined the neoconservative war on Iraq in 2003, but that's a large part of it. You know, millions of people on the streets in 2003 in London protesting against Tony Blair's involvement in the Iraq war. There's a sense of optimism that that with that number of people in a democratic society, that should prompt a change of policy. That doesn't happen. And in that context, a very small number of people think, okay, well, in this case, some kind of violence is now legitimate. You know, the word terrorism itself does a very good job of kind of camouflaging these relationships, right? So The Irish poet Brendan Behan famously was once asked, how do you define a terrorist? And he replied, he's the guy with the small bomb, right? So the, you know, what the word terrorist does is it enables us to focus all of our attention on the guy with a small bomb and ignore the violence of our own governments, right? Which is always greater and is in a kind of cycle with non-state actors, right? And so unless we understand that cycle that so our violence is being interpreted by non-state actors as a legitimation for their violence, and then we in turn understand that violence as a legitimation for our greater violence. Unless we understand that circular relationship that we're in, we're never going to create peace and we're never really going to tackle terrorism.
I think people in the movement have to be very clear. That kind of violence is unacceptable for a number of reasons. One is that it puts the onus of violence on us rather than on the government where it belongs. Right. And secondly, and most importantly, it substitutes the actions of a handful of people for a mass movement.
Absolutely.
And it leaves the masses of people on the sideline, even if they applaud it.
Of course.
They're left as non-actors.
Right.
So traditionally in the socialist movement in Europe and the United States, that kind of terrorism has been absolutely unacceptable.
Right. And that's a lesson that you know, the left learned, you know, 100 years ago in Russia in particular, right? But you know, let me just say one other thing on that, which is you know, when we make these arguments about the context, the political context that generates terrorist violence, you know, one of the things that people often say is, "Oh, you're being an apologist for terrorism, right? You're kind of somehow justifying terrorism, and therefore it's a kind of moral objection to that." Now, of course, anyone who uses violence against civilians has to be universally condemned, right? That's definitely correct. But if we're going to do that without hypocrisy, we also have to morally condemn the violence of the states as well, right? And of our own governments, right? So the moral argument here works the other way, right? The moral argument says we need to be consistent in our condemnation of violence, condemn al-Qaeda, but also condemn the drone strikes that kill much larger number of people, right? Much larger number of innocent civilians.
We've been speaking with Arun Kandanati. The Muslims Are Coming is the title of his book. The Muslims Are Coming, Islamophobia, Extremism, and the Domestic War on Terror, just out by Verso Press. It's the best book on the subject, and I urge our listeners to go out and get it and support their local bookstore and read it. There's a lot of wisdom in this book. Arun, thank you so much for writing the book and for being on Law and Disorder.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.